Now, the Radio Experience Special from National Public Radio, The Rare Recording by Joe Frank.
Let me begin by asking you a few questions, Eric. Could you tell me about some of your early experiences? That is, when did you first recognize that you did have this particular gift of extrasensory perception?
Well, Joe, it was several years ago over a period of time, no real traumatic moment. I began to have these daydreams, and what I thought were daydreams. Until over a period of months, they began to become more and more specific. Specific places were involved, people, conversations. And I found out that these places and these people, whose names I had imagined, actually existed. And little by little, it occurred to me that I was actually focusing in on the thoughts of real people and involved in real events.
Well, how at this time in your life do you distinguish between your own thoughts and those of others?
Well, that's very difficult, Joe, and it's one of the problems of being perpetually bombarded by extrasensory phenomena.
Well, I imagine it would be a distraction if you can't screen out other people's thoughts. It must be quite a jumble sometimes.
Well, it is. Only through experience is one able to attempt to get a hold of it. It's difficult enough, as you know, for one to keep one's own psyche together, and you can imagine when you're being bombarded by thoughts and impulses and bits of conversations from all over the place that it takes a very great amount of concentration in order to keep your own thoughts segregated from those of other people.
And it's all relative, too, Joe, because if you just turn inward on your own mind, you'll notice that thoughts don't come to you necessarily one at a time. They come in bunches, and you have the inevitable task of sorting them out one from the other. And all you need to do to imagine Eric's situation, and this is the way I myself understand it to be, is to extend that to include exponentially more thoughts, those of others in addition to your own.
Yes, sir, I'd say it's a fallacy, a common misconception in the neophyte in this field to try and distinguish between your thoughts and other people's thoughts. There are simply thoughts, Joe, and some of us are more capable of picking up a larger amount of those thoughts. I can pick up an unusually large amount of the thought that surrounds us all.
Yes, the inventor of ESP as we know it was Carl Jung.
Inventor does not sound like
no,
a suitable
perhaps
word.
No, perhaps that's not the word. He was the
first one who discovered it, I suppose.
No, not even that. He was the one who popularized. He was the one who put it in the terms that we know it today, who separated it from other psychic phenomena such as schizophrenia and paranoia. And reincarnation.
One more question. Can someone learn to have ESP?
Oh yes. As a matter of fact, I think most people.
So there are listeners out there who could develop this.
Oh yes. And I think there are books in just about any well-stocked bookstore that would give you exercises to train your mind. It's basically a question of mind control and controlling your own mind. And as you know, many people have said, and this is true, that human beings only use about 10% of their brain capacity. Mm-hmm. And we always say, oh, if we could use even 20%, what a miracle of a world it would be. I think learning to harness a person's extrasensory perception is something that most of us have to do. There are some naturals, like Eric, who don't have to do that sort of thing, but even they have to develop their powers once they discover them.
Well, perhaps we can move on now to a demonstration. You promised me that you would actually show me and our audience how this works. Not actually how it works, but that it works. So what we're going to do now is you can put those earplugs we provided you with on.
I have the earplugs. Let me just put them in, Joe, and make sure.
All right, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to think of something. I'm going to whisper it into the microphone so that the audience can hear what I'm thinking. I will tell Julian Behrens, Dr. Behrens. And then, of course, you, Eric, are going, well, Eric can't hear us, but Eric is going to then tell us what I'm thinking. I'm thinking of the atomic physicist,
right, Eric. Eric.
Yeah, may I take the air plugs out now?
Yes.
Yes, I'm getting something now. Something very strong. It's in the scientific area. I'm getting it now. Yes, I've got it for sure. You're thinking of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the physicist.
No, that isn't.
No, Eric, think again. Think again.
Are you sure you're not thinking of J. Robert Oppenheimer?
No, as a matter of fact, I just told the audience and told Dr. Behrens that I was thinking of Albert Einstein. That's who I was concentrating on.
You were thinking of Einstein and not Oppenheimer?
That's right.
You're certain of that?
Yes, I am. Absolutely.
Well, I can understand Eric's confusion. This is probably my fault. I'm a little bit nervous, what with being on the air and all.
Is there a fluorescent light in here, perhaps?
Yes, as a matter of fact, not only is there fluorescent light...
What does fluorescent lighting have to do
with it? Well, I'll tell you. Fluorescent light emits beta rays, similar to those that the human brain emits, and it can often get in the way. Not only that, but I happen to be nervous, and when the blood pumps faster, it influences the brain and causes it to emit gamma rays, which conflict with beta rays, so that it's very possible that Eric picked up a related person.
Mm-hmm. Let's.
Why don't we do another one?
I think that's a good idea.
All right. Yes.
Okay. Let me think of.
Let's turn the fluorescent light off before we do this, shall we? Thank you. All right. That's better. I feel clearer already.
Put the plugs back in.
All right. Let me just think for a moment. When you have to think of something, your mind goes blank.
The Statue of Liberty. Statue of Liberty.
Okay.
May I remove the earplugs now?
Yeah, sure.
I'm getting you strongly. Turning down the light certainly has helped. Yes, I'm getting a particular... It's a location this time. Mm-hmm. It's a historically significant place. Yes, I've got it now. It's Grant's tomb.
The Statue of Liberty is what I was thinking of.
I think we may have run into difficulty because they're both defenders of liberty. You see, mm-hmm. Grant being the defender of the Union and the statue representing liberty, the waves may have crossed each other. You see. I've never had trouble like this. I don't really.
Well, I'm very much
it.
Impressed by the fact that at least, you.
Well, he always at least comes close. This is very unusual for this to happen twice in a row.
Perhaps.
Well, look, Joe, I know what we could do. This perhaps would bring it more into the real realm here. We have been doing some additional experimenting in psychodynamics, mm-hmm. and one of the things we have been perfecting is a psychodynamic communication between Eric and myself, where we succeed in keeping 14 balls in the air at once. And we brought them with us. We'd like to show that to you right now.
We're trying to translate this gift into something that can actually be physically observed.
Okay, so you're going to have them circulate in the air simultaneously, all at the same time.
That's right.
All right, let's see.
All right. Okay, doctor.
Okay. Here we go.
Here we go. Put it.
Such as smoke signals, heliographs, semaphore, alpine horns, drums, telegraph, telephone, and ESP as well, among many, many others. We know as well that communication has been vital to the progress of the human race, because without communication, we would all be trapped in our own individual selves, and would be unable to bring about a greater unity, which, of course, is the object of all communication. Smoke signals were discovered early on in human history, when the members of a community, while they were working in the fields or were far off in the forests, could see a dark plume of smoke from the house of one of their townspeople, and this signal would cause them all to rush back into town and put out the fire. Then some Neolithic genius realized that when it was necessary to convene the townspeople, all he had to do was to torch one or two houses, and the resulting smoke would be enough to bring everyone rushing in. And it was not long before refinements in smoke signals were made, so that verses from the Quran and legal tracts and paragraphs on contract law could be communicated relatively simply by generating a very smoky fire. Smoke signals were not a perfect mode of communication, however, in that they were not visible over great distances, and on a windy day they were virtually useless, and they could not be used in rainstorms. The heliograph was invented by the Greeks. It works by taking a small piece of reflective material, like a mirror or a highly polished disc of bronze, and reflecting the light of the sun in coded signals. It was also very useful for boiling water and cauterizing wounds, but the heliograph had certain disadvantages. You couldn't use it at night, you couldn't use it during a thunderstorm, and if a natural phenomenon, like a mountain or a forest, stood in your way, it had absolutely no value. Also, the heliograph could not penetrate the thick clouds of smoke generated by smoke signals. And of course, it's well known that the Spartans were smoke signal senders and the Athenians were heliographers, and that during the Peloponnesian War, the Spartans were able to defeat the Athenians by jamming all heliographic communications through the use of very smoky fires. Semaphore are performed with a set of flags. The semaphore sender stands on a high place, which is visible, extending the flags from his arms in different configurations, using also flags of different colors, and a variety of communications can be sent. And only the most important affairs of state were communicated by this method in the earliest days. The king of Assyria, for instance, in 700 BC, sent the following message to the cities of the Mesopotamian plain to pay tribute or die. And I now quote, "You will render up unto me the payment due, else horsemen shall sweep across the plain and lay waste your homes." This famous message was communicated with flags. The first flag, depicting golden shekels and piles of silver coins, was waved in the direction of Assyria from the direction of the city of Ur. Then a second flag, in the tattered shape of a hand, grabbing towards the money and pulling it back toward Ur, was waved. This then was superseded by a third flag, depicting a large fist punching away at the hand restraining the passage of money.
During the time when I was in Amsterdam, I was playing out my death wish, and I traveled pretty much around the world looking for death.
Why didn't you just kill yourself?
Well, I wasn't looking for my own death, you see. I was looking for death in the abstract. I was looking for his face in the mirror. I used to go to funerals and climb into the coffin with the dead person.
Your face is in the mirror.
And
I always have
faces.
A strange sensation when I look in the mirror and see my own face when I shave. It always looks pretty unfamiliar to me, and it always changes.
You end up looking at your face probably more when you're shaving than you do when you're doing anything else.
You have a very odd face.
Every time
well,
I
you end
in
up
the
looking
mirror,
at the
I
face
the
in the mirror more when you're shaving.
Well, that's a very interesting thing, because the face in the mirror is really the reverse of your face, and what you think you look like is the reverse of what
I
you look like
thought
to
that
Yes.
Vibe people into dying.
There's a whole question about shaving cream. Which shaving cream you want to use when, or should you use shaving cream at all?
Well,
I find it's just as good with hot
death,
water rather than
in
have
death,
all
a clean shaven face is considerably more striking in death than
do you know that
than a face with shaving cream all over.
They left shavings all over the place.
Well, I mean, if you're clean shaven, you might as well be alive. But if you're dead, you should have a little beard
to say that
you didn't wake up that morning like every other morning and shave. You're
drugs
dead, and so you have a little beard.
To drugs too.
no.
Come on.
No. No.
Come on.
I can't do it.
Yes, you can do it.
I can't do it.
Come on. Right now, come on. Do it.
I can't do it. Don't make me do it, will you? I cannot do it. I can't do it. No. Don't make me do it.
Come on.
Don't make me do it. Don't, please. Okay?
Come on.
I can't do it. Don't make me do it.
Come on.
No. No.
Yes.
No, I can't do it. Don't make me do it, please.
Come on.
Please don't make me do it. Please don't. Don't.
Go ahead.
No, no. I can't do it.
Come on. Now. Come on.
No, I can't do it.
Have the problem of falling asleep. At the time that I was falling asleep,
Double sleep.
Yes, I would try. I would want to see, experience falling asleep, and so I would go to bed and I would try to fall asleep. And the next thing I knew, I'd be asleep.
That's a
be
very
morning.
Common
the next
problem.
Thing you didn't know, you'd
and
be
I could
asleep.
Never focus in on the moment because I'd fall asleep.
But you never know when you're asleep or awake when that happens. You know, you're in the middle of dreaming, and then you find out that you're really awake.
Well, I've begun to actually get a handle on that, actually, because
Another popular mode of communication was provided by the alpine horn. In the more mountainous regions of the world, in Tibet, the Swiss Alps, the California Cordillera, communication was achieved through the use of a horn, which was typically up to 20 feet long and required wheels in some cases. A single man who was trained from birth would blow it, a non-smoker usually with tremendous lung power. Unfortunately, there was one occupational hazard, which is that sometimes, if there was a stoppage in the horn, the blower would explode, leaving an unpleasant and distasteful mess which had to be cleaned up. The alpine horn was also a tremendous weapon. It could be pushed through a door, it could be dropped from a great height, and it could be used at night, as well as underwater. As a matter of fact, the subterranean city of Kaf, near Balkh, communicated entirely through a series of horns, which, in a later permutation, became speaking tubes. Speaking tubes were a Victorian device which predated intercoms. What they were, in fact, were lengths of pipe that would communicate between the entranceway and the inner sanctum of a given household, so that you could announce yourself in the speaking tube and be heard in an entirely acoustic way. However, speaking tubes fell out of popularity when they became a tool of vendetta, when sometimes a pressurized hose was put into a speaking tube to blow out the eardrum of the homeowner. Another disadvantage of the speaking tube was that you were forced to smell the breath of the person who was speaking to you, which was a great problem because, as we know, Victorian diet was extremely rich. But returning to alpine horns, The alpine horn was first used as a musical instrument in a little-known composition around the turn of the century. And so, after a rather elaborate and perhaps long-winded introduction, let me welcome you all to the Rare Recording. And in this program, we will feature the work of August Blenheim, a prolific German composer of the late 19th century. I'd like to begin with the aforementioned composition, the Orchestral Suite in A Minor for Alpine Horns and Violins.
Desert. And when I reached the top, there was nothing. There was complete nothingness, and I like
what
to interpret
mean by
my dreams.
Exactly? I mean, you know,
well,
no
that's hard to say, you know.
Nada.
Nada. You can't really explain it.
But I mean,
it.
Is nothing the absence of something, or is nothing an actual presence that exists?
Well, you know, at some point you just
what
have
color
to,
is
have
the
to
color of
take
nothing,
the leap
you know?
Into the abyss, you know? And this happened to have been...
Well, what if you're in the abyss already? What if you're in the abyss already? How can you take a leap into the abyss if you're in the abyss? What
well,
do you do then?
This was leap year, and that's...
Everyone
that's,
was leaping.
That is a year, yes, when it is appropriate to leap.
Well, I was lying in my grave, as I was saying, and the sand, they were dumping the ground on top, and I could hear it hitting the coffin.
Did you thrash?
And I didn't know how I was going to get myself out. And the next thing I knew, I was out of the grave and I was walking down the street, and I never knew exactly how it was that I got out of the coffin.
Oh, well, it's easy
and
to
I
explain.
Still believe that somehow I'm still in that coffin.
Well, no, you see, the coffin itself could have been an entrance into another street. This is what frequently happens. The whole
or it could
idea
have been a black
of
hole.
Is
in the Chronicles of Nunia, the coffin is the means by which the children enter into the other world. And, you know, that's just
obvious
sheer symbolism. I mean, well, let's talk about this fella's dream.
But what's left behind? And who is it that enters into the other world?
Well, it's you, obviously, isn't it? Or your father.
Well, but perhaps...
My boyfriend used to thrash around in bed. It was incredible.
Some women like it.
Years I thought life was either this or that, or neither this nor that. And then I thought, what if it's neither nor either or?
It's the problem of getting from here to there.
Exactly.
When you're here, you want to get to there, but when you get there, you're here.
Which makes you a nowhere man.
Well, it means that you'll never really get where you want to go. You say, oh, I would give anything to get there. So you go and you travel and you spend a lot of money.
And you're
tips.
Stuck in the middle with you.
Well, no, you get there.
But you never get there because the problem is
there's
no.
There,
it's the same as here.
Well, you always
it's
were.
It's here. It's so here. You are. Well, you're here at last. You say, wait a minute.
I've always been here.
Wait a
and
minute.
Here I am again.
Wait a minute. I wanted to get there.
And so you
so
have.
So they say, oh, you want to get there? That's back over there. But you say, that's where I came from. That was. That, yeah.
Well, the lesson of all that is that freedom is slavery.
Well, it's not so much that. So I think, like the whole problem about freedom and slavery, I think it's all a distraction against the basic existential void,
but
which
look
is
in
so
the
difficult
mirror.
For
look
people
in the
to get used to. What if you looked in the mirror and didn't see your reflection?
If you couldn't see those
chains around your wrist, you would not be able to shave closely.
What would you do?
Someone else would have to shave you. But you'd have to see your reflection or some reflection in order to shave closely, or else you'd have a 5 o'clock shadow.
That's one of the reasons why before they had mirrors, everyone had beards.
Mm-hmm.
Blenheim's Orchestral Suite in A minor for alpine horns and violins, a rare recording indeed, and a piece which, when first performed in Berlin in 1902, was received with howls of derision and sneers of contempt, an illustration of failed communication. Blenheim was forced to seek other forms of employment to survive. He restored the felt hat bands that were popular among the bourgeoisie of the time. He was a fruit inflator, and he passed out handbills in the street dressed in the head of a lion and the body of a lion, but they were two different lions, a very daring and innovative concept. Although Blenheim was sure that he lived alone, sometimes when he looked in the mirror, he felt a stranger was watching him. He tried to introduce himself, to break the ice, but they always spoke at the same time, awkwardly canceling each other out. And it was like getting from here to there. He couldn't do it. "I can't read your mind, whatever I do," he wrote, pinned under a rock like Sisyphus. Words.
I went back to Paris about 3 years ago. And one night, I don't know what possessed me, but I just had to find the Hotel de Paris. I had to find the place where I had been when I was just a child. And I went to the place where I remembered it being, and it wasn't there. And I said, well, maybe I remembered it wrong. And I started to walk up and down the streets, and up and down the streets, and it was a foggy, misty, rainy night. I looked at all strange faces. I didn't ask anybody where it was because I didn't speak a word of French.
I very often had the experience of feeling unfamiliar, not be able to find my way in the mundane circumstances in which I've been all my life. It's sort of a reverse deja vu. I come to a place that I know I've lived in, and I know I've been, and yet I can't find my way around. The streets are unfamiliar to me. People look unfamiliar to me. I feel lost. This happens quite often. And it leads me to think that perhaps I'm not really the person that I thought I was. Perhaps I'm not the person that was in this place.
You have been listening to The Rare Recording, a program by Joe Frank. Performers included Bernie Mantell, Eric Sears, Arthur Miller, Irene Wagner, F. Murray Abraham, Christina Moore, and Joe Frank. The Rare Recording was written by Joe Frank and David Rapkin. It was directed and produced by Joe Frank. Executive producer, Keith Talbot. The Rare Recording is available on cassette. Send $6 to Radio Experience, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. The price again is $6, and the address for your copy of Joe Frank's The Rare Recording is Radio Experience, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Funds for this Radio Experience special were provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.